The nation is mourning the death of President George H.W. Bush. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, it's a special encore broadcast of President Bush at the University of Kansas Lead Center. The 41st president received the Dole Leadership Prize from the Dole Institute of Politics on November 16, 2008. Bush spoke to a sold-out crowd at the Lead Center as George W. Bush was about to leave office. The elder Bush spoke with Dole Institute Director Bill Lacey about his own political career, reflected on the presidency of his son, and gave some advice for then-incoming President Barack Obama. Today's program was originally broadcast on November 23, 2008.
Thank you all very much. Mr. President, welcome to the University of Kansas. We're delighted that you would honor us. You and Bob Dole were rivals at different times in your career. You both sought the presidency in 1980, 1988, but you became really fast friends after that. Talk a little bit about your relationship with Senator Dole.
Well, the reason we became fast friends was because the way that he treated me when I was president, and he was leader, he was leading the Republicans in the Senate, and they were not in a majority back then. But he did a superb job. He gave the president the benefit of the doubt. I always knew where he stood. I could not have asked for anybody in the Congress, House or Senate, to be more forthright or more strong in supporting the agenda that I was elected on in 1988. So I have great respect for him. We had a friendship before that. We served in the House together, and I've kept up with him. But this is what really cemented the relationship.
You know, John mentioned in his introduction the skydiving, and I always wondered if maybe that was born out of a little bit of frustration that you, after you flew 58 combat missions, and you actually ditched in the Pacific one time, but you didn't jump out. You just took the plane down, and then they rescued you by submarine. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I rescued by submarine, but I used the parachute to get down there.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't do it very well. I don't like, you know, old guys telling war stories or terrible. I'm afraid if I tell you how much I did in World War II, he'd start telling me, well, let me tell you what I did out there in the German. And your memory gets a little dramatic. But it was September 2nd, 1944, and it was a cold day. No, but I I jumped out of the plane, didn't do it well, hit my head on the tail as we were going down, and was picked up, rescued by a submarine. But because that didn't work as perfectly as I'd like to have thought it would, I then decided when I came back and out of all this that I'd make more jumps. And I have. I've made six or seven more. And Barbara has a funny way of expressing her enthusiasm for that. She said, one way or another, this will be your final jump. Well, I said, you can express it a little differently than that. But no, people say, why are you doing something dumb like this? And I'll tell you the answer. There's two answers. One, it says that just because you're old, you don't have to sit around drooling, you know, and doing nothing. And it sends a word. The second one is it sends a word globally around the world that you can get in and do stuff. And I've had more people from abroad mention this, and it's a thrill. It's a thrill.
We had an extraordinary career. Tell us kind of how you got started, why you chose public service. I mean, you dedicated your entire life to that.
Well, I was lucky that I had a father who inculcated into his kids the idea that public service is a noble calling. And I still feel that way. I feel strongly about it. In fact, we have at my library at Texas A&M the George Bush School of Government and Public Service. And the idea is to further that message. Public service is a noble calling. And in these tough times of the internet and blogging and all this kind of stuff and saying nasty things about people, it's a good thing to do is to project that idea that public service is noble. And it is. I really believe it. So when it came my chance to serve, why, having served in the Navy, I then decided that I ought to try to get into politics. And we did, and it worked.
You worked with a lot of incredible people during your career. One of the individuals that you served was President Nixon. Tell us a little bit about President Nixon and how you interacted with him.
Well, Nixon wasn't what you call a cozy guy. He was not a But I owe some of my career to him because he appointed me to things, and he appointed me to be United Nations representative, permanent representative of the UN, which I found to be extraordinarily broadening experience. And I was in that job, I was a member of the cabinet. Then he asked me to be head of the National Committee, which I did not find to be a broadening experience, because you want to try about being in a lousy job, try to be president of the Republican Party, chairman of the Republican Party during Watergate. It was ghastly, no combat pay, no nothing. And so Nixon was a very interesting guy, very bright. He had a kind of a downside to him that you've all read about in those tapes and all. But overall, he was had a broad vision of where America ought to be in the world, and I owe him a great deal.
Another very interesting, connection that you had was President Reagan. You waged a very spirited campaign against President Reagan in 1980, then you joined him as his running mate. What do you remember most about that campaign in 1980?
I remember losing very badly to Reagan. I didn't know him well. I knew him. I was chairman of the National Committee, and he was a governor. And so he had a kind of a group around him. He's coming down the hall. You know, he had a big deal going. He wasn't that way at all. But I didn't really know Ronald Reagan. And so when he asked me to be his running mate. A phone call came in out of a clear blue sky the night before the convention was on, and it was the night before he had to make a decision on it. I said, of course I would. And it's the luckiest thing that ever happened to me, because he was a kind man, a strong man, a decent man, and he had a certain vision for our country. So my life has been enriched by Ronald Reagan, and he was wonderful to me in every way. Every way.
Well, you guys were a great team, so.
Well, I don't know. I hope so.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. What that period of time was really remarkable, and I guess a lot of historians say that President Reagan was arguably, along with FDR, the two most successful presidents of the last century. What do you think made Reagan so successful?
He had a few principles, and he advocated them, and he stayed with them. Reagan had many tax increases while he was president, but he'd say, I hate taxes. I want to lower taxes. And he just was very clear on what he really wanted. And so he had to accept compromise from the Congress, people were not suggesting that he'd betrayed his philosophy. So he was very strong on that. But the thing that I remember the most was his common decency. He would no more walk by a guy out there in the yard in the White House fixing up the yard and without saying, how's your family, how are you doing? He just wouldn't do that. And he was kind to everybody. And so I saw up close what I hadn't seen when I got to be his running mate, this innate kindness and courtesy. It was just a wonderful, warm human being. And I think that did come through to the American people.
In 1988, you sought the presidency and were very successful. That was an extraordinary campaign. Everybody expected a very close election because, generally speaking, as everyone here knows, when a party's been in power for 8 years, you have a tendency to go back the other way, and yet you won an Electoral College landslide. How did you feel about that campaign, and what was your main goal when you took the oath of office?
Well, in winning the race, I didn't have the problem of trying to run away from the president. His record was good and strong, and so it was easy for me to embrace most of what he'd done. He had this Iran-Contra thing, but that was just a hiccup in history and didn't mean a damn thing. So I wasn't trying to cut distance between myself and my friend, the president, when I was vice president. So that I attribute it largely to the fact that in that time, at that election, the Republican nominee was really running on a good record for the incumbent president. Made it a lot easier, made it very good.
One of the visuals that we looked at over at the Dole Institute is you being sworn in, and there's Bob Dole behind you.
He was really very successful to you,
or very helpful to you while you were president in the Senate.
Extraordinarily helpful. And probably, you know, he ran a good campaign and we were political opponents and all. But the best of the thing in our system, you come together and work for a common good and common goal. And I could not have had a better leader on our side. He was absolutely wonderful. And I was very proud of what he did as a leader. In fact, we got very emotional when I left the presidency because he put on a dinner for me. Howard Baker was up there and I said, where's Nancy? She here? I don't see, what do you mean, there, up there? No, cut it out. But I had great respect for Howard as a leader. And then Bob Dole, of course, but they had this dinner up there and it was just, for me, very emotional. I'd lost, I'd felt badly about that. It hurt to lose, believe me, it hurts a lot. You, not so much for yourself, but you just feel I've let down a lot of people. It's tough. But both of them were extraordinarily kind. And Bob, that just followed, you know, in character, because that's the way he was to me when I told the time I was president.
You had a number of remarkable accomplishments as president, but I think probably history will know you best for the first Gulf War. Talk a little bit about the very impressive coalition of allies that you assembled before you chose to go ahead and go and take military action.
Well, it was not without controversy. And the Democrats made it a party line vote as to whether to give the president the authority to which was granted in the United Nations resolution, to, quote, use whatever means necessary, unquote, to end the aggression against Kuwait. I took that seriously, but before that, I decided we had to do something about this. But a lot of people didn't think we ought to. And as I say, George Mitchell, I think it was then, made it a party line vote. We were able to detract several Democrats to stay with us in voting for giving the president the authority to fulfill that UN resolution. So it was controversial. We forget that because of the superior way that our troops acted. But remember, this was right in the wake of an unpleasant experience for the nation in Vietnam. And a lot of people were wondering, well, can our military really do the job? Can they perform? So it was scary running up to it, because the toughest decision the president has to make of any kind is when you send somebody else's son or daughter into harm's way. There's nothing else compares. The budgets are tough and taxes are bad, but this is the toughest decision you make. What did he say?
That's okay. Please, please, sir. That's not respectful.
I can't.
The Dole Institute of Politics encourages civil and respectful discourse. My suggestion to you folks is that if you can't be civil, that you might want to leave.
C'est la vie. C'est la vie. That goes with the territory.
Sorry, Mr. President. Can we do something? Let me ask you about the coalition. It was just an extraordinary international coalition you built to do that. How did you go about building that coalition?
Well, everybody was outraged by the brutality of Saddam Hussein in Kuwait. And so some wanted to do something about it, and some didn't. But for a man to go in and gas people in the neighborhoods and all of that, it was pretty easy to mobilize world opinion. But we had many nations on our side in coalition, and they all determined that the objective would be not to kill him, but to just simply end the aggression. And that was our goal. And thanks to a superb military, that's exactly what we did. In 100 hours, we defeated the fourth largest army in the world. We got that dictator out of Kuwait and did what we set out to do. And I think there's a good lesson in history for that. And that was it. It was very clean, and a lot of people We had some demonstrators beating drums out in front of the White House. I don't know why they used pots and pans. They ruined our dinners always. But guys like this, but they're expressing the right to first free speech. But I think the nation came together, and certainly they came together after they saw what our military could do, because there was some doubts about it after Vietnam.
One of the tough decisions, I know you've been asked about this a lot, but I'd love for you to explain this to everyone here. You chose not to go into Baghdad and get rid of Hussein. What was your thinking behind
that decision? Well, the goal, the objective, as enshrined in the UN resolution and our policy, was to eliminate the aggression, to get him out of Kuwait. And I've often wondered what would have happened if he just picked up his weapons and moved back to the border between Iraq and Kuwait. We'd have been in a real dilemma. But he didn't. He elected to fight, and that's when he got clobbered. But I think once we had the victory, I didn't have any second thoughts about whether we ought to redefine the mission, because we had a lot of coalition partners who had agreed, free, independent nations, that what we would try to do is eliminate this brutal aggression against a member of the UN, Kuwait. And so it never occurred to me that we ought to expand the mission.
Okay. One of the other actions that you took while you were president is you sent military forces into Panama. Talk a little bit about that decision as well.
Panama was Operation Just Cause, and what was happening was our civilians down there and some military were being harassed by the PDF, the Noriega forces. Noriega was a convicted or condemned international drug dealer. And it was essential that we not permit him to use those forces that he was dominating as a dictator to harass the United States interests there. And so that was fortunately not too major a military action, but it did serve a good purpose, and that is to say that a dictator who was condemned as an international drug dealer would have to face justice. In fact, he's in a prison over there in Miami, I think, today. I hope they don't let him out and let him go to Texas.
What would you characterize as your greatest accomplishments as president? Obviously, the Gulf War would be one of them, but...
Well, the Gulf War, in a sense, not just because of the victory over to free Kuwait, but the Gulf War because it ended this canard that our military was no good, and our military was on the ropes after Vietnam, and they weren't. And one of the proudest things I remember is when coming down Constitution Avenue with Norm Schwarzkopf at the lead, a lot of Vietnam veterans paraded there too, because when they came back, a lot of them came back and were spat upon and degraded. But so I think the fact that not only did the forces fight well and do well, but that they then in the process lifted the burden from the backs of people that were serving as volunteer army, serving in Vietnam. And that was a kind of a collateral advantage that we hadn't thought about when we started. Mm-hmm.
So many changes, like John was saying, so many changes took place during your presidency. I mean, one of the most dramatic things, and I'm curious about your thoughts, when you were told that the Berlin Wall was coming down.
Well, that was an amazing feeling, and I remember doing the diplomacy with Gorbachev and with Helmut Kohl to try to get it peaceful. You got to remember that the Soviets had a lot of troops in Poland, in Hungary, especially in the GDR, the German Democratic Republic, East Germany. They were there, and we didn't know how they were going to react. The Congress.
And,
what's her problem?
I'm sorry, Mr. President.
Don't worry about it. What's she saying?
I can't really tell.
I can't hear her, unfortunately. I'm deaf and old, but I heard a lot of noise.
They're gone.
Where were we?
Well, 20 years ago, I remember standing on the floor of the Republican convention listening to your acceptance speech, and it was a stunning speech. It's one of the best speeches I've ever heard, and I've heard a lot of, obviously, President Reagan's and Senator Dole's and others. But your famous line from that was, "Read my lips, no new taxes." Then you kind of got roped in. You kind of got roped into a tax increase a couple years after that. Do you regret that it turned out that way?
I regret saying that because if we hadn't put it in such clear verbiage, it wouldn't have been a big issue. But I was convinced I wouldn't, and tried very hard not to. But I did not want to see the government shut down again. And we had to make a compromise. And in return for that modest increase, we benefited from some saving cuts. And I think in terms of the budget and the effect on the economy, it proved to be right. In terms of politics, it proved to be wrong, because the words were so flamboyant that people never let me forget it, and I could understand that.
Well, most everyone here knows that I worked for Senator Dole and worked for President Reagan, but most people don't know that I worked in both of your campaigns in 88 and 92. And we lost prematurely two individuals that were critical in the 88 campaign and were my good friends as well. Everybody's heard of Lee Atwater, but everybody probably hasn't heard of Bob Teeter. But talk a little bit about Lee and Bob and how they were important to your career.
These were I don't forget what you call them, but they worked the details. And Atwater was a great communicator, and he knew the base, and he knew where he needed to get the vote out, and he could tell you who won the Alabama primary back in 1972, and he could tell you what happening in Maine in 1960. He knew all these facts. And he was a hard charger, fighter. When I was chairman of the Republican National Committee, he had a big role there, working with the young Republicans and all of that. More than that, actually. And he was a great political operative. Teeter was perhaps the most experienced pollster in those days. The Republican did mostly Republicans. He didn't all, not entirely Republican, but I relied on him for polling information. And they were both professionals, and in politics, you got volunteers are what gets you to the finish line. And we get you, in my case, got me started, coming from an asterisk in the polls to winning the primaries. But you need people like that who have the history and know the game, you might say. And so I think I was blessed to have both of them. Bob Teeter, unfortunately, died of cancer, and Atwater of a brain tumor, I guess it was.
Yes.
But both were very good men, and both were extraordinarily loyal to me.
One of the things that that really amazes me about your career is that you've served continuously, and you continue to do so today. You've gotten together with President Clinton and done incredible fundraising activities on behalf of Katrina and tsunami victims. What drives you to continue doing that when you clearly, you know, it's not something you have to do?
Well, when I was president, I talked about being one of 1,000 points of light. And this was taught to me and inculcated into me by my family, my dad, service to others. There can be no definition of a successful life that does not include service to others. And that's what that's all about. And so when Katrina hit, Bill Clinton and I joined forces. I hadn't seen that much of him after I lost to him, but I had always had a pleasant relationship with him, and we decided to try to do something about it. So we took a plane and went out to Indonesia and Maldives Islands and Sri Lanka, and he treated me with great deference and kindness, almost like a father to him. I'm that old, but it was extraordinarily thoughtful. And there was, for example, there was one bedroom on this airplane. It was a U.S. Air Force plane. And this was an official mission for the president. And I said, "Now, Bill, you take this room from here out to Honolulu, then I'll take the room the next leg." No, you do it. So I got up halfway out to Honolulu from the West Coast, and there he is curled up on the floor of the plane in the next room. And he didn't have to do that. He was extremely considerate and kind to me. And that's, I saw that as a difference, you know, something I hadn't seen close up. And we worked together, and frankly, we're good friends. And a lot of my friends don't understand it. We got a lot of different views on different things. But he's been a joy to work with. Now we've done it again on the Gulf Coast. We got a new fund where we're trying to raise money to help the Galveston and the Gulf Coast area that have been hurricane stricken. And it's a joy, but it's one of 1,000 points of light, helping others. That's what he's in it for, and that's what I hope I'm in it for. But I'm not doing many of those things anymore.
Well, we just had a very historic election. Our party was pretty decisively defeated. What's the future of the Republican Party?
Hey, listen, you remember 1964? Republicans were all sitting around and wringing their hands. We got wiped out in the Goldwater year. Lyndon Johnson winning by huge majorities, losing many seats in the Congress. 2 years later, we elected, I think, 60 new Republicans, and I was one of them, to the House of Representatives. And we started back. And so this is what goes around, comes around. And I've called President-elect Obama, wished him well. He's got huge problems, not of his making, that he has to contend with. And I think everybody ought to get behind him and support him. But when it comes to how we're going to try to do these different things and what details will go into the economy or into the international affairs, I think those of us who differ with him on some of his policy have the obligation to speak out. It won't be I. It'll be younger people, more vital, like you are here.
Most of these folks won't like it if I do that, though.
Well,
so I have to be bipartisan.
Okay, well, you be bipartisan. Where's what's her name? That beautiful girl who was helping me.
Becca.
No, but people, Republicans are wringing their hands, and I didn't have a chance to talk to the governor about this. She did a good job working for her candidate, but I wish him well. I called him and told him that. I had a nice conversation with him, and I mean it. I'm sincere about it, and he's got a huge, many problems in front of him, but it's historic, let's face it, proudly historic. So we'll give him a chance, and then if he starts messing up, why, I'm sure the loyal opposition will do what it should do and challenge him.
Okay, we're going to have one other question, and then we're going to bring some members of our student advisory board out to ask questions that have been posed by the community. But Mr. President, you were on this, and I want to continue with just one more question about President-elect Obama. Speak to, based on your, 60 years plus of experience in public service, what advice would you give him about serving as president?
Well, I think I might be one of the last people he'd turn to, but I just say, do your job. Don't be deterred by interruptions in the press on your case and all that stuff. Do what you think is right. And he starts off with a pretty good advantage. All my years in the presidency, four of them, I was opposed by the Congress, both houses of Congress. Both were in the opposition party's hands. So they started from day one going after me. President Obama will start with the people in the Senate and the House supporting him. And my advice would be just do what you think is right and sell the American people on it. And if you get hammered on some legislation, turn around and stay in the game. But I think he'll do pretty well to begin. And then when the reality sets in that this is a huge job and there are enormous problems out there that one president can't solve, and when the opposition says, hey, we're not going to go along with that, even though Republican opposition in the Senate and House is fairly modest in terms of numbers, he's going to find the tough realities of politics. And you're going to find that you're going to have to compromise from time to time. So I don't think he needs any advice today, having won this superb victory. But I think we ought to support him. And I think he ought to prove what he's made of by trying to get his program through.
Well, the one thing that I would say about the president-elect's victory and about where our party is that unfortunately for the Republicans, we don't have the bench that we had back in the 60s. We don't have George Bush, Ronald Reagan, Howard Baker, Bob Dole, all those guys who are all seeking the presidency, and I think that's going to be a real challenge for us.
Well, we've got some young leaders there that will come up, and they'll turn the spotlight, will fix on them, and you'll see that there's some pretty good talent there. And they're not going to quit. They're not going to go away. So I'm somewhat bullish when I look at some of the individuals, and I think that, as I said, in 64, everybody said, we're down and out. 2 years later, we're riding high.
Okay. Well, we're going to ask our student advisory board members to come on out. And what we did is, I think, come on out, Alex. We solicited questions from the community, and they're going to be presented by members of our student advisory board.
Hello, Mr. President. My name is Alex Roth from Lawrence, Kansas. My question comes from Tracy Bedell from Lawrence, Kansas as well. What one achievement during your presidency are you most proud of and why?
What achievement in your presidency were you most proud of and why?
Well, I don't know. I think Desert Storm, because it renewed respect for the U.S. military, and I love dealing with the military. I was a part of it many, many years before that. And it showed that the United States, when it gave its word on something, would follow through. You see, my firm belief is Saddam Hussein didn't believe we were going to do what we did, and further, he felt if we did do that, he'd win. And I think we disabused him of that, and there was a message that transcended what happened in Iraq for that. But I think the Americans for Disabilities Act that I get some credit for working with the Congress is historic. It was probably the best piece of civil rights legislation in the last 25 years, offering people that start off with disabilities a chance at the starting line. I think that was good. We had some other, we did pretty well in the environment, as a matter of fact. So, but I think the thing that probably will be noted by historians the most is the Desert Storm.
Hi, Mr. President. My name is Julia Groblocker, and I'm from McPherson, Kansas. I got really lucky and got to ask my own question. During the current financial crisis, do you believe that the historically conservative stances in support of cutting taxes and loosening business regulations can meet the needs of the middle class and decrease poverty in our country?
Do I believe if we use those principles, it will decrease poverty? I say you can't do it right now because you're right in the middle of a financial crisis. But as an underpinning for a philosophy, I'm for that. But I don't think that the question of regulation is what's causing the problems we're facing today. We're in a cyclical downturn, not only here, but it's global. Look around the rest of the world. And some of the countries that are enjoying it or fighting it are almost socialist in nature. Some of them are. And the rest of them, some of them are very conservative philosophies. And yet they're all facing the same problems. So I think the thing is, you don't want to give up on your fundamental principles if they're right and if you believe they're right, but you got to adjust for the times, and you got to be pragmatic and practical when it comes to solving day-to-day problems. I remember being in the Congress when they voted on the Chrysler bailout. Well, I was all against that, and the government stepped in, put a lot of money in Chrysler, and got paid back. Now they're doing, in these bailout things. I must confess to certain being somewhat troubled by it. But you just can't let a lot of people be thrown out of their jobs if the government is able to step in. Having said that, you shouldn't advocate that this is what I'm going to do from now on, bail out every country company that's in trouble.
Okay. Next question.
Hello, Mr. President. My name is Andrew Toth. I'm from Colby, Kansas, and my question comes from Owen Cox from Lawrence, Kansas. Being a former president and head of the CIA, what potential implications do you see in the possible closing of the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center? Will this lead to an increased use of extraordinary rendition, and how will it affect our world standing?
I'm not sure I know enough about what the facts are on rendition. I've read a lot about it, but I don't know what's fact and what's not, and I have not been briefed on all of that. Let me start by saying I've got a lot of confidence in the CIA. I was head of it for one fascinating year, and it was so different than what public opinion was. And there are more PhDs in that Langley than there are in many smaller universities, more. And they're knowledgeable in their fields, and the fields vary from weather to crop growth and all these things, as well as fighting terror and the what everybody thinks of as the clandestine action. And so I don't know. It's a good question. I just don't know the answer to it. But I don't think anything we're doing is going to lead to more of that. And to the degree, I've got some concerns about Guantanamo myself, but I don't think it's going to end all the problem with these terrorists. I just don't think it will. I know one of them was released, went over to back to the Middle East, and was doing bad stuff again. So, but we got to respect the rights of people, even those that are fighting against us. But we don't ought to be naive about it and think that closing one base is going to solve all these problems.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. President. I'm Amanda Applegate from Wichita, Kansas, and my question comes from Representative Ron Worley of Lenexa, Kansas. Considering your past relationship with China, what guidance or assistance can you provide world leaders regarding China's role in solving our environmental and overwhelming pollution causes?
Well, first place, I think it's absolutely essential that the United States stay involved with China. I've served there, as you may remember, as ambassador, equivalent of ambassador before we had full relations. Back in the 70s, Barbara and I had a fascinating time there. And I've been back there many times. In fact, I've been to China, I think 12 or maybe more than that, 15, 16 times since leaving the presidency. And I know all those leaders. I don't believe there's a communist left in the bureaucracy in China. They're totalitarians. But when I first went there, they had that little Mao's red book, you know, and they're reading the dictatorship of the proletariat and all that nonsense. But you don't get that anymore. You have people that are, as Deng Xiaoping brought about this change of opening up markets, free markets, freed up the markets, and incentives for business. And so China can teach us just as we can help them. I don't think they're seeking hegemony. I don't think they're seeking control over their neighbors as they were back in the Vietnam, post-Vietnam War days. I think they want to be a member of the world community, which they didn't. When I was at the UN and they came in for the first time there, we couldn't hardly get in to meet with any other countries. But now they're involved in all these international agencies. They're smart people, strong people. They got their own financial problems, and they know they got environmental problems. And if I went to China for the games, and for a moment, they had Beijing pristine, and the air was clear and all of that. Well, what'd they do? They just shut down all the automobiles and they get off the road. I don't think you can do that forever. But I think they're aware that they've got a leadership role to play. And that's quite different than it was when they first came into the international community, because back then I don't think they felt any responsibilities at all. Now they do. The guy I would give credit for was Deng Xiaoping, who brought them from this command economy into a market economy, and also opened up China. When we were living there, Barbara and I was living there as your ambassador, equivalent thereof, we couldn't go to anyone's house. We couldn't be seen talking on the street to Chinese. They had people following us up the hutongs when we go up there to a store, and it was very different. And now it's very open, and if that openness continues, I see China continuing to be a major international player. They're big enough financially to be there anyway. So it is my hope that they will, three Chinese guys in the audience, it is my hope that they will play an important role in the future, and we neglect them to our own peril. They're that big, they're that strong. They are not seeking hegemony over their neighbors, in my view. Their military today is insufficient, you might say, compared to U.S. and some other NATO powers. But they're on the move, and we ought not to sit on the sidelines sniping at them. We ought to stay involved with them.
Okay, next question.
Hello, Mr. President. My name is Jesse Vaughn, and I'm from Mound City, Kansas. And my question today comes from Kathy Wiggins from Atherton, California. Please comment on what it was like to have your son follow in your footsteps into the White House as president. More specifically, what was your criteria for offering advice versus keeping your mouth shut?
Keeping his mouth closed or mine, did you say? What was the last part of it?
Offering advice versus keeping your mouth shut.
Oh, well, I vowed that I would not be the old guy standing around, you got to listen to me, son. We just don't work that way in our family. He won, He surrounded himself with some very good people, and he kind of did that. You remember the old song by Frank Sinatra, "I Did It My Way"? So I'm very proud of him. I think he's taken a lot of unfair hits, mainly from some of the journalists, the New York Times. Don't mind singling them out. And I will be delighted to have him. We're a close family. We're a very close family. And I will be delighted on January 20th when he gets back into the bosom of family, out of this daily crossfire. But I am proud. I've stayed out of the criticism business. I probably have had some differences of what I might have done if I'd been there. But I vowed from day one, as you asked about, that I would not be the old man writing notes, "Do it this way, son," or, you know, arguing about this policy or that. It's been tough on our family because you don't like to see somebody, think of your own kid. You don't like to see your own people get hurt or hammered away. But he does not feel sorry for himself. He does the best he can, keeps his head high. He does it with honor, I'll be glad when he gets him back home.
The next question comes from Ken Saboski from Wichita, Kansas. Mr. President, when you were a candidate for a second term as president in 1992, you stated that you wanted a kinder and gentler nation. What did you mean by that, and do you think that America is more kind and gentle now than it was in 1992?
That was a little bit of rhetorical flourish, but what it meant was that we ought to not be arrogant, we ought not to be throwing our weight around. And I think basically the American people understood what I meant, and whether we are or not, let the historians decide that. I think we probably are. People that are very critical of our policy in Iraq, if you ask them a simple question, "Would you want to bring back Saddam?" and say, "Oh no, we don't want to do that." I mean, these calls are not easy for a president. So on that one, there's a lot of controversy, but you didn't hear much about it in the campaign. Why? Because it's going better. The surge was successful. And so I think it's a little early to talk about how history will judge this president, but in terms of my advice and all that, I'd leave that to Barbara.
Mr. President, the next question comes from Richard Norton Smith from Alexandria, Virginia, who was the first permanent director of the Dole Institute of Politics. You were criticized in some quarters for not going to Berlin when the wall fell and, in effect, doing a victory lap. Modesty aside, what were the factors that led you to forego the ultimate photo op? And do you feel you were ultimately justified in your decision?
Well, I have great respect for Richard Norton Smith, and he sized it up as the ultimate photo op. But here's what happened. I was sitting in the Oval Office and around the desk there, some of the reporters were huddled around, and one of them said, "Can't you express the emotion the American people feel as walls coming down? Can't you do what Gephardt and Mitchell," who was head of the senior moment here?
Mitchell, one
Mitchell,
too.
And her suggesting you go and dance on the wall. Well, I didn't tell her, but that's the stupidest idea I ever heard. We had worked. I was very polite. "Oh, no, thank you for that." But the reason was we did not know how the Soviet military was going to react. We knew, and Gorbachev subsequently said he didn't know how they were going to behave. And they were down on him for his role in working with the West. And we didn't know whether that would be the final straw that broke the camel's back. And so we decided we would cool it, not rub the Soviets' nose in the fact that they lost, we won, that kind of thing. And the victory lap is a good way to establish it. You get over there, you might get 3 points in the polls. But you might also diminish the chance for a final peaceful solution. Remember, the Berlin Wall came down, not one single shot was fired. And in the reunification of Germany, not one single shot was fired. And so sometimes it's better not to overreact and not beat your breast and say, "We did it," you know, and parade around. And I don't think it cost the United States anything. And I can tell you, that Gorbachev has subsequently told others and me that if we'd have done it differently, he didn't know whether he was going to survive as president of the Soviet Union. And well, I've gotten very close to him, incidentally, so we speak quite frankly. And it was not easy, because it'd been nice to go over there and see the hard work of many predecessors of mine be vindicated. But I think we made the right call. Sometimes it's better to be, I got called, you remember Dana Carvey? Not gonna do it, wouldn't be prudent. Well, sometimes it's good to be prudent and forego the headline and look at what follows on. And so I'm very proud of our reaction, our team's reaction to that, and the results speak for themselves. So I think we did the right thing.
I take it that, based on what you just said, that you're not as pleased with Dana Carvey impersonating you as Bob Dole is with Dan Aykroyd, because he was very fond of that.
Well, I like Carvey. He was there the other day in Houston, and he and I went over there and did a little stand-up along that same line. He's a good man, and his humor, incidentally, never was mean. It was never... He sure stung at times, but it was never hurtful. You never felt as vicious. And some of these guys today that, under the name of humor, just go right for the jugular. He didn't do that. And so I liked the man, and he teased me a lot. Nah, I gotta do it. Nah, I gotta do it. And went on like this. But it was a good lesson for me in the way he conducted himself. He was very popular. In kind of teasing me, you might say, but he was not a nasty guy.
Okay. We have time for one last question. Andrew, you get the last one.
Mr. President, this question comes from Jonathan Earle of Lawrence, Kansas. Do you think there will be another president with the name Bush?
Well, I don't really see that. We got a guy that was governor of Florida who was a superb governor. Now, that comes from the father, but you check with most people on both sides of the aisle in Florida, and Jeb left office with very high ratings, very strong, very policy-oriented. And I don't think he's got politics totally out of his system, and very, very candid, I hope not, in spite of the nastiness in the political arena today. Then we have a rock star in George P., who is Jeb's oldest son. Handsome guy, interested in politics, surprisingly, and lawyer. Name it Naval Reserve in the Naval Reserve, and I'm very proud of him. And I think maybe he will go into politics, but certainly he's not arrogant enough to start running for president with doing nothing in the political arena. He'd need a little seasoning out there.
Right. Well, you got over at the Dole Institute this afternoon, you got to meet some of the members of the Student Advisory Board, the folks who've been asking you questions. We've got, I think, over 80 Dole scholars here today attending. What advice would you give to these young men and women who are following a career or who want to follow kind of a route that you followed in your life, committing your life to the service of other people? What advice would you give to them?
Well, I can't think of a better example than Bob Dole. I think they can... You know, service is noble. Service is, and participating in the political process is good. You don't always have to be out there shouting or, you know, trying to get your name in the papers. But participating in the process, get involved. Be in somebody's campaign. Run for office yourself. Help somebody else. But then you get the feeling of it, and I think you, the rest is history. You stay involved. And so it's good. And, you know, these guys yelling at me, that doesn't bother me anymore. I mean, it's just goes with the territory. And you have to get used to it. You may not like it particularly. But it's the process works. And I think President-elect Obama, when he started off against Hillary Clinton, nobody gave him a snowball's chance. But he did, he stayed with it, put together a great coalition of supporters, and set a huge example by the majesty of his win. So it can happen, and I think, what supported him were a lot of young people on the internet, a lot of young people in the campaign itself. There's a good example, and we've had, McCain had the same support from people. So I just say, don't despair. The guy that sits around, I can't do anything, my voice doesn't make a difference. It sure doesn't if you sit around whining about it all the time. Get in the game, do something. And that's what my advice would be to those guys.
Well, Mr. President, it's been a great honor for us to have you here today, and this is the Dole Leadership Prize for 2008, and we again thank you so much for coming to accept it, and we appreciate your service to our country. Thank you so much.
Give my best to Bob.
You bet. You bet. Thank you. Thank you all.
You've been listening to a special encore broadcast of the late President George H.W. Bush, who received the 2008 Dole Leadership Prize at the University of Kansas Lead Center on November 16, 2008. Coming up, Senator Bob Dole on the passing of President George H.W. Bush and a remembrance by Bush's former Secretary of State and good friend, James Baker. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we are KANU Lawrence 91.5 and KANH Emporia 89.7. We're on the web at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio comes from local restaurants, including Fuzzy's Taco Shop, that provided food for volunteers and staff during KPR's membership drive. Fuzzy's Taco Shop is located at 1115 Massachusetts Street in downtown Lawrence. A big thank you to everyone that phoned in a pledge or pledged online during our membership drive. Your end-of-year gift helped us raise more than $38,000. It's not too late to make an end-of-year gift. Donate online at kansaspublicradio.org. And thanks. I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, we're remembering President George H.W. Bush. One of the last people to see President Bush before his passing was his former Secretary of State and good friend, James Baker. 10 years after Bush won the 2008 Dole Leadership Prize, James Baker was the recipient of the 2018 Dole Leadership Prize. At the November 7th event, Baker recalled how he got roped into politics by George Bush.
I lost a wife to cancer when she was only 38 years of age, and leaving me with four small sons. But I had a friend in Houston who happened to be my tennis doubles partner. And he came to me and he said, "Bake," he said, "I want you to help me run for the Senate here in Texas." And I said, "Well, that's great, George. Except for two things. Number one, I don't know anything about politics. And number two, I'm a Democrat." He said, "Well, we can cure that latter problem. And when I'm talking to a group of Republicans, I say I got religion. And when I'm talking to a mixed group, I say I changed party. So you can take it any way you want." But I never intended to go into politics and public service in my life, and that's how it happened. George Bush is an extraordinarily thoughtful, kind, and considerate person, and he was looking out after his buddy. He said, "You know, you need something, do something to take your mind off your grief." And that's how I happened to get into politics and public service. I don't think we've ever had a president who was any more well-prepared in foreign policy when he became president than George Bush. And I will tell you this, and this is, I know I'm biased because I'm his friend of 40 or 45 years or whatever. I ran all of his political campaigns and he's my daughter's godfather. But with all of that hanging out, I gotta tell you, he's the best one-term president this country ever had. If you look at the record, and he's one of the very best presidents of all time. So, a very fine person to work for, but his foreign policy credentials were superb. He'd been our first ambassador to China. He'd been vice president for 8 years and attended every National Security Council meeting that there was. He'd been ambassador to the United Nations. So when we were confronting the collapse of communism and the change of the world as we had known it for the 40 years of the Cold War, we couldn't have had anybody better prepared to be at the helm at that time than George Bush. And he made it clear right off the bat to all of us, we're not going to do any gloating, no triumphalism, And so he got a lot of grief from the press for not being sufficiently animated about the world having changed in our favor after 40 years of the Cold War. But he refused. He knew that we still had a lot of business to do with Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, Shevardnadze being the foreign minister of the Soviet Union. And he wasn't going to stick it in their eye. He knew they were cooperating with us, working toward reform. But we got a lot of grief about that from the press and from some elements of the right in our own party. You're being too soft on these guys. And as it turned out, we weren't. And for 15 years, people forget this. Today we're in a new Cold War with Russia. No doubt about it, ladies and gentlemen. But for 15 years after the implosion of the Soviet Union and the collapse of communism, we had really good relations between Russia and the United States and between Russia and NATO countries. That's all gone now. And it's regrettable, but it's the way it is.
That's former Secretary of State James Baker speaking at the Dole Institute of Politics on November 7th, 2018. Baker received the 2018 Dole Leadership Prize 10 years after his friend George H.W. Bush received the same award. Baker was one of the last people to see Bush before his passing Friday, November 30th. Senator Bob Dole and Senator Elizabeth Dole issued the following statement remembering President George H.W. Bush. Our nation has lost a cherished servant leader who has truly been the man for all seasons. President Bush answered the call to serve whenever our nation needed him, and we needed him often and in so many important capacities: congressman, vice president, director of the Central Intelligence Agency, ambassador to China, and as the 41st president of the United States. He brought wisdom, a keen sense of mission and diplomacy, incomparable patriotism, along with compassion and humanity, to each and every assignment he accepted on behalf of the American people. We smile when we recall the photographs of President Bush and his beloved Barbara riding their bicycles as they forged new paths of friendship during their years in China, or the skydiving adventures to celebrate his birthday. He created the Points of Light Foundation to remind us that we each hold the potential to help and inspire others. In retirement, he continued to inspire us, leading by example as he graciously stepped off the world stage, continued to meet with leaders who sought his wise counsel, and navigated with courage his final illness. God bless this great man of faith and hold our dear friend close. That's a statement from Senator Bob Dole and Senator Elizabeth Dole, recalling President George H.W. Bush. The director of the Dole Institute of Politics, Bill Lacey, worked with President George H.W. Bush and released this statement. I had the honor of working with the president in the Reagan White House and on his two general election campaigns. He was an extraordinary guide for America during the critical transition after the fall of the Iron Curtain. In visits to the Dole Institute this year, presidential historian Richard Norton Smith and former U.S. Secretary of State James Baker remarked on the importance of President Bush's leadership during those years. That's a statement from Bill Lacey, director of the Dole Institute of Politics at the University of Kansas. Before that, we heard a statement from Senators Bob and Elizabeth Dole, as well as former Secretary of State James Baker, from his recent appearance at the University of Kansas. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.